cried out, let alone who was firing, as she was on the comm with Barker, warning him to self-destruct the instant the number one engine went out. She jerked her head up. There was the base, lit up like a Christmas tree, if you doused the tree with oil and lit it on fire, that was. Bomb clusters and missiles squirted away from its surface. Green energy globules burst out. Only the underside of the station was still dark, the massive array of whatever Smythe had identified staying out of the fight. Tolvern closed her eyes and gripped the handrails, bracing for one final flash of light, and then, well, whatever came after you died. They only stayed closed an instant. Then she was back at work, ordering the gunnery to deploy countermeasures to roll away, to fire back at the attacking lances, which continued to tear apart the remaining armor. One of her torpedoes landed a lucky blow, and the wounded lance tried to retreat. But then the base's firepower joined the battle, and it struck Apex hard. One of the twisting bomblets caught the wounded lance and blew it apart. Energy globules hit other enemy ships and affixed themselves to their skin. They quickly engulfed the silvery surfaces, and the ships disappeared beneath glowing plasma.
"We're still targeted," Cap said, "but they aren't shooting at us, not yet."
"Maybe it's that big array," Smythe called over.
"Whatever it is, it's not something we want to face."
"Time to run, Captain,"
Cap said.
"No."
Only one of the lances had escaped the bombardment, and it tried to flee the suddenly revealed battle station, which carried it toward Blackbeard. By now, Blackbeard's starboard side shields were weaker than those on port side, had been completely obliterated, in fact, and Tolvern had turned about to keep her weak side away from the action. This brought the main battery into play. A few seconds later, the lance came hurtling past, and Blackbeard let loose. The cannons were highly developed kinetic weapons, designed to punch through Tyrillium armor that could repel standard energy weapons. They'd been of limited use against highly maneuverable Apex lances, which could scorch human and Hroom ships from a distance. But this lance had come within range and felt the full force of 16 heavy guns. The cannons fired shot made of cobalt rods to penetrate the shields, and explosive shot to tear through the resulting holes and detonate on the interior. The lance took it all. What was left afterward didn't even rise to the level of confetti. They'd destroyed 7 lances in a matter of minutes. Well, the Albion cruiser had destroyed one, and the battle station had obliterated the other 6 in a spectacular display of firepower. And the Singaporeans hadn't even fired up that unknown battery, but kept it targeted on Blackbeard.
7 lances, Tolvern said aloud. Not 8. One of them got away.
She asked Jane for an assessment. The news was grim.
Number 2 engine destroyed. Number 1 engine leaking plasma. Emergency shutdown initiated. Port shields 8%. Starboard shields 2%. Deck shields.
All right, I get the point. Cap, call engineering and tell them to keep the number 1 online. I don't care about the risks. I need to get out of range of that station. Nib Pim, take us around the planet. We'll try to talk to them from there.
What about the missing lance? Cap asked.
I'm taking my chances, Tolvern said. I think it made a run for it. These guys in the battle station have us targeted, and that's what's got me worked up.
It's an asshole move, Cap said.
Not how I'd put it, but yes, not exactly friendly. Maybe they'll attack, maybe not, but I have no intention of rolling over and showing our belly in submission if they demand our surrender.
Aye, Captain,
she got on the comlink. But when they tried to get away, they found they were caught in some sort of gravity net that disabled the plasma engine. Before they could find a way to hack loose, a tether crossed the thousands of kilometers between the base and the Navy cruiser and affixed itself to the hull. Blackbeard had machinery to cut loose from a boarding attempt, but of course Apex had disabled the machinery in the savage mauling.
We need to send someone out, Tolvern decided. Do we have anyone out working the hull?
No, sir, Cap told her. But Carvalho and some of his mates are suited up, ready to fight the buzzards if they knocked a hole in the ship and tried to come in.
Good, we'll send him out.
Only he don't fancy them spacewalks. Says he feels like he's falling.
Cap would know. She and Carvalho were longtime lovers who had hooked up during Blackbeard's foray into piracy during the Civil War. Some of the crew they'd hired on in slummocky New Dutch and Ladino ports around the sector had been actual pirates, and a fair number of these had stayed on after the Civil War wound down. Half of them were probably suited up in engineering alongside Carvalho, disappointed they hadn't seen any face-to-face combat with Apex drones.
"All the same," Tolvern said, "he's a man who knows how to get things done. I'm sending him out."
Ronaldo Carvalho listened grimly, as the head of engineering delivered his orders with a scowl and his silly walrus mustache waggling. What was with that mustache, anyway? Didn't Barker know it was 30 years out of fashion? While a second man checked the seals on Carvalho's suit and noted his life support readings, Barker went over a list of obvious stuff, from how the pulse torch worked to warnings about where to run the tether. The armor was so riddled with holes, there was a real chance of kicking a sensor or snapping off some other vital piece of equipment.
"Yeah, I got it," Carvalho said.
"Do you? You don't look like you've got it. You look like you're barely paying attention."
"Because you're wasting my time with all of this trivial stuff. Do you think I am slow because I speak with an accent?"
"Shut up and listen, will you?" Barker said. "The mag clamp should work so long as you keep away from that gash in the deck shield. You'll want to steer left of the number 3 tube as well. And as for the main battery..."
Carvalho grunted as Barker droned on. Pompous Royal Navy geezer. These Albion fellows with their stiff necks and their way of looking down on a man with the wrong breeding or from the wrong place. He just wanted to get it over with.
"Now let's talk about how long you've got to get this done," Barker said.
"Listen, pendejo, you think I'm going too slow? You crawl out there yourself. Or better yet, shut your hole and let me get started."
Instead of voicing this thought, he said,
"I will move as fast as I can, Chief. But I have got to do it safe, right? Don't want to lose my grip on the ship if these Genos give us a tug with their tether."
But he'd misjudged where Barker was going.
"You weren't listening to anything I said, were you? What I'm saying is that you've got time. Don't rush it. The base has neutralized the thrust from our plasma engine, but we're pushing with auxiliary power, and they can't haul us in too fast, or they'll yank themselves out of that nice little hiding place they've made for themselves. I want to send a piece of that tether down to the lab, and you're going to cut it off for me."
Carvalho couldn't help staring. "You want a piece of their rope?"
"That's not a bloody rope, you fool. It's a self-healing carbon nanotube tether. There's something weird about it."
"In other words, a fancy rope. Sure, I will cut you a piece."
Carvalho patted his utility knife, which bore a striking resemblance to a long, curved dagger.
"Look, you can't just hack off a piece. What do you think is going to happen?"
Carvalho considered.
"Well, I suppose with them pulling in one direction and us pulling in the other, if I cut it, the whole thing will vanish at about 500 times the speed of a cracking whip. If I am holding on to the end, I'll go with it. I'd probably let go, terrified, and then I'd float away in some random direction, curious about how long my oxygen would last."
Barker grunted.
"I guess you do understand. You are far too literal, my friend,"
Carvalho said, slapping him on the shoulder with one gloved hand.
"But why cannot it be cut, say, 2 feet above the ship? The rest whips away, and I will pry off the end and bring in what is left.
I'm pretty sure it has fused with the Terrillium, if Smythe's readings are correct. Anyway, you don't want to touch the thing. Use this instead."
Barker brought out a length of what looked like a short, squat piece of pipe, except that it opened in the center, like the vacuum canisters they used to shuttle mail packets around on Carvalho's homeworld of Nuevo Tejas. Carvalho eyed it doubtfully.
"And that is going to do the job?"
"Haven't you used this before? It's for cutting off pieces of Terrillium for testing in the lab."
Carvalho took it and turned it over in his hand.
"Oh yeah, seen it, never used it. It's easy enough to operate. Just don't get your hand caught inside if you know what's good for you."
Barker spent a minute showing Carvalho how to use it, and for once, the Ladino was glad to hear it spelled out in detail. Up until the chief started repeating himself.
"We are wasting time," Carvalho said. "I want to get out there."
"Again, there's no rush. You have an hour. Maybe a little longer. Tell me if you need more time, and I'll let you know how we're holding up."
An hour sounded like plenty, Carvalho thought, as he entered the airlock a few minutes later. But when the outer doors opened and he stared into the vacuum, he froze in place. There it was. The endless void, the stars bright and immobile against the sky. He couldn't get over how they sat, like sharp pinpricks of light, no matter how many times he looked at them. They didn't look like the glimmering stars one saw from the surface of a planet, shimmering through an atmosphere. Barker's voice came over the comm.
"You're still tethered to the airlock. Is everything okay?"
"Yeah, it is all good," he lied. "I am getting my bearings, is all."
"Fine, fine, I'll leave you to your work. I'm here if you need me."
That was a relief. Last thing he needed was Barker looking over his shoulder the whole time, giving instructions step by step.
"No, no, the left foot, the left!"
Carvalho chuckled, and this steadied his nerves. He took a deep breath, willed his pounding heart to stop trying to hammer its way through his chest, and reached to untether the suit. Almost too late, he remembered to activate the mag boots first. He muttered an oath in Ladino, the one about dogs and cats doing unnatural things to each other.
"What's that?" Barker asked.
"Talking to myself, I will stop now."
And by stop, he meant turn off the outgoing comm so nobody else could hear him cursing to himself or crying for his mama. Mag boots activated, he untethered and clomped out of the airlock. The kettle lay to his right. It ate up a quarter of the sky, a coppery, glowing ball, but wasn't the most impressive object in view. Even more dramatic was the ice field that swept from horizon to horizon, like a rainbow of diamonds, bisecting the wider but less bright Milky Way to form a giant, glowing cross. The ice field reflected against the surface of HMS Blackbeard, which looked midnight blue beneath its light, except where the more orange light of the planet pooled in the holes formed in the pitted Tyrillium armor. Blackbeard was a Punisher-class cruiser, 489 feet from her engines to the tip of her deck gun, and in the docks looked like a long, sleek predator of the deep. Now she was a mess. Carvalho hadn't seen a surface so pockmarked since the faces of the whores on San Pablo. He made his way slowly over the surface of Blackbeard, an eye out for the gashes and other obstacles Barker had warned him about. The canister floated on a cord next to his utility belt, reminding him of his purpose. It felt as though the ship were lying motionless, but that was all illusion because there was nothing close enough to measure himself against. In reality, the Chinos were dragging the ship toward their base. Better them than Apex, he supposed. But if he were the captain, he'd fire a couple of missiles down their gullet to let them know not to mess with the Royal Navy. Carvalho made his way midway down the hull, where he came upon a streak of black shadow that emerged next to a damaged torpedo tube. The shadow stretched, like a thin, never-ending string, from the ship hull toward the gleaming swath of ice crystals arcing overhead. It was wider up close than it appeared from a distance, but was still no thicker than a pencil. Impressive feat, hauling in a 500-foot warship, struggling like the universe's largest fish on a line, without snapping. Cap's voice came through the comm. "You all right, Lav?" After several minutes of hearing nothing but his own breathing and the soothing murmur of his life support systems, her rough York accent jolted him. He flicked on his comm so she could hear him.
"I was until you startled me. Now I am floating free. I think I have damaged my thrusters. Damn it, no way to get home. Nice going, Cap. Now I am going to die."
"Don't be an ass," she said cheerfully. "Barker told me not to bug you, but you've been out 20 minutes already, and those Chinese fellas are still reeling us in. So if you wouldn't mind getting to it already, we'd be appreciative down here."
Had it been 20 minutes already? These graph boots made slow going.
"I am fine."
"I'm sure you are, love, once you finish wetting yourself inside that suit."
"Hardly. If you want to know the truth, I am admiring the view."
"Get us out of here and I'll show you a view that will make you forget the stars."
"Is this an open channel?" he asked.
"I hope so. Make them all jealous. Telvern is sending me off shift for some sleep as soon as we're cut loose."
"But I don't feel like sleeping. You know what I'm talking about, my bandito."
Carvalho grinned, The woman was insatiable. Well, it was good motivation to stop wasting time and get this dumb thing over with. He reached the tether. Even up close, it was as black as background space, only visible from the lack of stars in a straight line out from the ship. He turned on his helmet light, but even this didn't penetrate the strange substance. He wanted to grab the thing, feel if it was soft or hard as steel. But Barker's last words had been a firm warning. They didn't know what it was, and he might just grab it to find out he no longer had fingers on that hand. Oh, and a severed pressure suit. He'd only feel the pain of the severed fingers for an instant before he was extruded out the end of his open glove and into the vacuum of space. Barker must have been tracking his progress because he started speaking through the comlink. A bunch of unnecessary instructions. Carvalho turned the volume way down so he could keep working. He took a moment to tether himself to a perforated piece of the portside armor and tested it by releasing his boots and pushing gently against the hull. There was a terrifying moment as he floated away, and he almost thumbed on the thrusters to bring him back to the ship. Then his cord caught, and he hauled himself back in and reattached the mag boots. "Here I go," he said, turning up the volume again. "You're strapped down?" Barker asked. "There is going to be one hell of a recoil." "Of course." Carvalho unclipped the canister from his belt, opened it, and eased it against the line, hauling them into the base. Being careful not to let his suit brush against that deadly pencil-thin shadow, he reached over the top and closed the canister with what felt like a snap, though of course there was no sound. Nothing happened. In order to bite through the ultra-dense yet absorbent armor, the canister had two heat-treated pterillium blades. When the canister closed, motors in the canister forced them together at high pressure to make the cut. It had closed without difficulty, but the pencil of shadow passed right through it. The other end did not snap off under pressure as Carvalho had expected. Whatever it was kept its pull right through the canister. He eased it away, but the shadow still didn't disappear. For a moment, he thought it must have passed right through the canister, and he'd come away with nothing. But there was a hole in the pencil line. A 5-foot piece was attached to the ship. Then there was a gap of about 18 inches through which he could see stars, and then the rest of the tether disappeared into the void. The two pieces were drifting away from each other, inch by inch. Shouldn't the auxiliary power already be forcing them farther apart? It only lasted a moment, and then the outer line snaked out and connected with the small piece still attached to the ship. They were fully tethered once more. Carvalho looked down at the canister in frustration. Should he attach it to his belt, or try again? He wanted to hurl it into space in frustration.
"What's going on out there?" Barker asked. "Why haven't you cut the line?"
"I did," he said. "Or tried to."
"Well, try again, why don't you? They're still hauling us in."
Carvalho explained what had happened. This brought a series of oaths over the comm. The chief's voice vanished from the line, and Captain Tolvern's appeared in its place a few seconds later.
"That's it, Corporal," she said. "Quit screwing around and get back in here."
"I think I have a sample," Carvalho said. "That is something, no?"
"They're holding our sorry butts in for interrogation, or worse. I don't think the composition of their tether is really a top priority at the moment. You tried to cut us loose, you failed. Good effort, no one's blaming you, but it's time to get in here."
"The canister cut through the tether," he said. "It made a hole, I saw it. Then it reformed. All we need is to cut a bigger piece. If we bring someone else out to join me, or get me a longer line and two canisters, I'll float out and make two cuts. Maybe if they're separated."
"No time," she said curtly. "We're down to a few minutes."
"Hold on," he said, thinking.
He wasn't sharp or witty like Cap, and he didn't have the ability of many of the tech officers or engineers to come to rapid, highly accurate conclusions. That made him feel slow and stupid sometimes, but he was a thorough thinker. The wheels in his head may turn slowly, but they reached their conclusions all the same. At last it came to him.
"I will cut the tether again. You will turn on the plasma engine and get us out of here before it reconnects. Captain?" he said after a longer pause. "Are you there?"
Tolvern's voice came back on.
Jane says the engine will spit plasma on startup. You'll most likely be cooked alive. She puts your odds at 12%. A high uncertainty, admittedly. Might be as high as 30%.
Carvalho swallowed hard. Perhaps it is for the best. To save everyone, I will take this risk.
Nice gesture, you old pirate, the captain said. But no way. I'm not taking that kind of risk with one of my crew. Not when it will probably fail anyway. When we're not even sure what these guys want. Come inside, Corporal. That's an order.
Carvalho breathed a deep sigh of relief as he disconnected from the ship and turned away from the tether. He trudged over the hull with the mag boots yanking him down on each step. A sacrifice? What the devil had got into him anyway? Throw away his life on the off chance of saving a bunch of people he didn't care about and never had? Okay, maybe he cared a little, but not as much as he wanted to save his own skin. He looked out for himself and always would. What about Cap? Did I do it for her? Nah, that couldn't be it. She was a warm body in bed, as good a friend as he'd ever had. But they'd always had other lovers. Never talked about anything ridiculous like quitting the Navy and setting up respectable-like, with a house and family. And forget marriage. He'd better not let Cap know what he'd been thinking, or she'd mock him mercilessly. Marriage, huh? It was a ridiculous notion that would be better off tossed into the void. He glanced out to space, as if it were possible to do so literally, and this brought a wave of vertigo at the vastness of it. He whipped his head back down to the solid ship hull, and he discovered hardened goo at his feet. It looked like a mound of freeze-dried snot, as if a star leviathan with a cold had hawked up a loogie and spit it onto the ship. Curious, he bent to take a closer look. After a moment of thought, he realized what it most likely was. Probably the epoxy shot into the heat shield of the number two engine. When the engine blew, it had melted the epoxy and splattered it against the deck, where it rehardened. He bent and poked at it. Except that didn't make sense either. No epoxy could have survived the death of the number two. Would have disintegrated to the atomic level. Oh, and they'd vented the number two on the underside, the only place where the armor was still thick enough to absorb the blast. It wouldn't have landed here. Carvalho was probably wasting time, and some idiot would start screaming in his comm to hurry up, but he didn't think he should just walk away. He took out his maligned utility knife and stuck the point into the hardened snot. It was like cutting rubber, but he got a piece of it easily enough. It was about the size of his thumb. They could always come back for a bigger sample if it turned out to be something interesting. He unfastened a pouch on his utility belt, pried out the needle-nose pliers and let them fly, then shoved the snot inside where the pliers had been. When he glanced up, the ice field nearly covered the sky. There was a big chunk in the middle that had a strange mirror-like quality to it. An object of some kind, he saw, as the reflected light from the planet hit it just right. The base. It was coming up fast. Carvalho lowered the pull on his grav boots and tramped as fast as he could for the airlock. Chapter 10 Commander Lee watched through the viewscreen as the battle station hauled in the Albion warship like a giant fish on a hook. The ship had struggled trying to break free, but now exhausted, had no fight left. She'd even retracted her cannon, closed her torpedo tubes, and cloaked herself. The message was clear. We pose no threat. We will not resist. HMS Blackbeard. That's what the deciphered message called the ship. She was long and sleek and deadly-looking. The armor on port and starboard showed gold rampant lions on the outer shields, like something from medieval heraldry. A skull and crossbones glowered above the deck. Wasn't Blackbeard the name of a famous old Earth pirate? What was the story behind the ship's name? Anna stood next to him, arms crossed.
Maygod is putting together a boarding party, but we'll need several hours before we're ready.
I'm not ready to give those orders yet. I need time to think.
You've had 11 years to think, brother. Do you think you're going to have an original thought now after all this time?
11 years, but this was our first battle. That changes things. Lee smiled. It sure feels good, doesn't it?
Anna's scowl disappeared, replaced by a fierce grin. The mood throughout the command module was jubilant. Every message coming through from the rest of the station was either boastful or congratulatory. There had been shouts when they fired their weapons, roars at the first hit, and dancing when it was all over. The youngest crew members were nearly 30, the oldest well past retirement age. Yet they were as enthusiastic as a crowd of children. Alone among the crew, Lee had maintained his equilibrium. Mostly. The swarm of plasma globules from the ejector had been a thing of beauty. The terrified flight of the lances had brought cheers, and when the enemy ships burst like rotten fruit thrown against a stone wall, he'd joined the hugs. They'd even shouted when the Albion warship tore apart the last Apex ship, stealing a little bit of Sentinel 3's glory. But one lance was missing. The birds had no doubt sent messages before dying. The veil of secrecy that had sustained them for so many years had been torn in two.
"I want that warship," Anna said. "There's unknown tech on board. We can strip out weapons, disassemble armaments, take what we need, and use the rest as a floating battery."
"What of the crew?"
"What of them?"
"There are who knows how many humans on that ship," Lee said. "You propose taking their ship, stripping it, and doing what exactly with the crew?"
"A few of them might be useful to plug gaps in personnel. We can't put them in critical positions, obviously."
She scratched her head and glanced at Magot, who sat at a nearby console, sending messages to some unknown person or persons.
"What do you think?" she asked her confederate. "Where is the safest place to put them, the least critical system?"
"Everything is critical," Magot said.
"Yeah, but I'm thinking we put them in food, water, power, not weapons, communications, or engineering. We'll pull our people out and use them elsewhere. At the least, the new crew will be useful for replacing openers where we can't tolerate them any longer."
Heat rose in Lee's face. "Don't be ridiculous. This Blackbeard has a captain, a woman named Jess Tolvern. She's a loyal subject of her king and commands a warship as powerful as anything in the Imperium fleet."
Anna made a grand gesture at the viewscreen.
"Not so powerful at the moment."
"You're a fool if you think they'll meekly surrender."
She nodded at Magot.
"Hence the boarding party."
"So you'll fight it out, killing anyone who resists, and taking the rest prisoner? That's your plan?"
"More or less. Unless you want to demand a surrender first. I wouldn't advise it, though. That will only give them more time to prepare."
"They're already preparing, you know they are." Lee shook his head. "I don't know what tricks they'll have planned, but it's something nasty, and some of our people will die."
Anna's expression didn't change.
"And? We've got the manpower, more than enough to fight this thing and win it. We have the weapons. If the resistance is too great, we'll retreat and blow holes in their oxygen plant until they suffocate."
"Monstrous. The only thing they did in the battle was destroy one of the enemy ships."
"After leading the whole fleet of birds right to our hiding place, that's reason enough to kill them all."
Lee shook his head. "No, I'm going to demand their surrender. Promise them safety if they abandon their ship and take the positions we offer them. If that fails, we'll make a decision, maybe a harder one."
He realized as he said this that he'd accepted her default position. The Albion ship belonged to the battle station. The Singaporeans would force the crew from its crippled ship and take positions on it solely as a floating battery for when Apex returned in greater numbers.
"Let me handle this," Anna said. "You're too cautious. You'll make it sound like an invitation to supper. I'm going to knock them down and kick them in the ribs. When they stand back up, it will be on my terms, not theirs."
"You'll have a fight on your hands."
"Don't you understand? That's exactly what I want. I'm going to thin the ranks. When it's over, there will be no doubt who is in charge."
No doubt who was in charge. At the moment, Lee had no idea himself, his sister and her henchmen, apparently. But what was his choice if he stood against her? Defect to the openers?
"There might be 100 crew on that ship," Anna added. "If we bring them all over, there'll be a constant threat. An entirely new faction, imagine it. She nodded.
We'll break its back before it happens. Force the violent ones to fight us. Kill a few of the tough ones. Detain the leaders. The others will come around in a hurry. Watch.
Don't do anything. That's an order.
I told you it will take several hours.
Anna, he warned.
You've been working straight through, she said. Get some sleep, John. Enjoy your rest. You deserve it. A great victory, thanks to you. I'll worry about this Blackbeard. When you come back, we'll be ready to go. You can take over from there. Direct the operation personally if you'd like.
Lee looked around the command module. In addition to his sister and Magad, there were half a dozen others, only one of whom was armed. That was another of Anna's sentry faction goons, a big ox-faced man named Zhong, who should have been working down in Septic, but had replaced a suspected opener as fire control liaison. Most of the others were known associates of Anna's as well. Swetnam was the only opener still in the command module. He was on the opposite side of the room, back at work getting the sensors and communications equipment online, and hadn't appeared to have followed any of the conversation. A smart guy, loyal, but nobody to stand up to Anna or Magad. Then there was the first officer, Harold Ong. Loyal enough, but too old to support Lee with any energy in a conflict. This was not the time to make his stand. Lee nodded. I'll be in my quarters getting some sleep. Wake me if anything goes wrong. He hesitated. Or if you're ready to attack early.
Of course.
He rubbed his eyes.
I'm tired and probably overthinking this. I am grateful for your help. There's a lot of pressure on my shoulders is all.
It will work out fine, you'll see.
A flicker of relief on Anna's face.
Yes, I'll bet you're relieved. A commander who doesn't protest when his underling stages a mutiny. How weak do you think I am?
Lee kept his face neutral as he left the command module. Inside, he was boiling and planning his next move. As soon as the door shut behind him, he made a private call to Swetnam's comlink. 5 minutes later, Lee stepped into the detention cell holding Hillary Coe. The tech officer lay on the cot, hands behind her head, staring, or rather glaring at the ceiling. She jumped to her feet and sprang at him as he entered. He flinched, thinking she was going to attack, but she only grabbed his shoulders and shook him, a wild look in her eyes.
For God's sake, tell me what happened. I know nothing. There was a battle, wasn't there?
How did you know?
I felt a shift in the artificial gravity. The light changed in the room. Then there was movement in the floor, a sort of vibration. Must have been weapons going off.
He pried her hands off his shoulders.
I don't believe you. The detention block is on the inner hub, and you wouldn't have felt any of that. How did you find out?
Co stepped back and uncertainty flickered on her face.
I see you formulating a lie, he said. Don't bother, tell me the truth.
Through the comm,
which we'd turned off as soon as you were detained.
I know.
In other words, someone hacked into the comm to get you a message. Was it Swetnam?
I'm not sure.
It was an obvious lie.
A friendly source, that's all I know. Please, what happened? That much I don't know, I swear.
We won. 8 Apex Lancers appeared. We caught them by surprise.
Why? How?
And destroyed 7 of them. The 8th vanished.
It escaped?
She drew in her breath.
Oh, that's bad. What about the human warship?
It destroyed one of the lances, took some damage itself. We have it tethered and are hauling it in.
Ko's face lit up.
Wonderful.
Not so much. Listen, Ko. We're caught now. Apex knows where we are, and they'll be back soon enough. We can hide for a while, but they'll find us eventually. When that happens, we'll be fighting for our lives.
The woman's face hardened. She looked like a younger version of Lee's sister with that expression, her position unyielding, no matter what new information she learned. Once one chose a faction, one never went back, it seemed.
It was worth it.
I should have your head, Lee said. This discovery is your doing. My sister wants to throw you into the recycler. We'd be eating little particles of Hillary Coe by the end of the next grow cycle.
Do it, Lee. Or rather, tell your sister to do it for you. I know you don't have the guts to kill me yourself. I made a decision and I'll stand by the consequences.
I'm not here to blame you for what happened, Lee said.
Sounds like you just did.
She settled back onto her cot. What do you want, Commander?
I want to not attack the Albion warship. I want to negotiate with them to form an alliance. A weary wave of the hand.
You're the commander, what's stopping you? Oh, wait, of course. It's your sister and her friends. Hard to say no to your own family, is that it?
I know what the situation must look like, but I had to throw in with one side or the other or be devoured by both. You defied my orders, and my sister's desires were aligned with my own. Or so I thought.
Now you've realized you've made a blunder, haven't you?
It wasn't a blunder. It was the right decision at the time.
At the time?
Circumstances have changed. The Sentry faction wants to strip the warship, impress some of the crew into service, and wait. And then what? Best case scenario, we fight. We drive Apex off while they search for easier prey, and we wait some more. Years. Decades. Eventually, Apex returns to finish the job.
That's no change. That was more or less our orders all along.
Except we could make an ally. The warship fought the Lancers, destroyed one. What is their navy like? How many ships do they have? What new tech and tactics do they have? What can we share with them?
Great, Commander. Why didn't you think of this before?
We were under attack, Co. What did you expect? Anyway, it doesn't matter. What matters is that Engineer Lee and Engineer Maygott have taken over the command module. They're moving their people into all positions. I'm a figurehead, that's all. Soon enough, I won't even be that.
What happens when the crew of the warship says no? Co asked.
They won't be asked. My sister is going to assault the captured ship and kill a bunch of them, including the officers. The survivors will be pressed into service, maybe. That's what my sister claims. She also claims it will take several hours to prepare her assault team, that I'll return to the command module just in time to oversee the operation. That's a lie to keep me out of the way while they do it.
Obviously. Co gave a disgusted shake of the head. A brutal, monstrous plan, no surprise knowing those types. They're completely mad.
So I'm throwing in my lot with the openers, and I want your help.
Co didn't speak, and so Lee pressed on.
Swetnam is in the command module. He has access to all communication systems, to automated security.
Lee licked his lips.
No doubt my sister is going to throw him out for someone else, but she hasn't yet, and for now he's our man on the inside. He's the one who hit my track so I could come here and talk to you.
Commander Lee shulking around his own battle station, how heroic.
I'm not proud of it, but what else could I do? The point is, I want your help.
I can't help, Commander. I just decided to throw my lot in with the openers myself when I sent that message.
You're lying.
No, really, this time I'm not.
I know what you think of me, but I'm no fool. You didn't just come up with that hack to the communication system. Not when communications was mothballed for so long. You may be good, but you're not that good. You had a backdoor all along.
Wild conjecture and completely false.
Have a little respect for the both of us, Lee said. Stop lying. You are in with the openers, and what's more, I think you're high up in whatever organization they have.
Again, the long hesitation, and again he could sense her weighing a lie against the truth. Let's say I admit it, she said at last. What is it you want exactly? And what are you offering in return?
I'll get you out of here for a start. Once you're out, I need your help retaking the command module.
To what purpose?
To the purpose of keeping the Sentry faction from killing people, from alienating our only potential ally, from gutting the ship that is the only possible way we'll ever get help.
Sure, but that doesn't put you back in charge.
Who else would it be?
Commander Lee, what fool would throw her weight behind you now? You've as good as lost your battle station to your own sister. She wasn't even second in command, or 14th in command for that matter. She's a combat engineer with a few ruthless men and women behind her, nothing more. You didn't even put up a fight.
You have no idea how difficult my position is.
I know you're weak and spineless.
I'm not weak, I'm desperate. 11 years of isolation, no orders from the Imperium, ever. Meanwhile, the whole damn base goes nuts. We've divided into 2 groups of religious fanatics.
1 group of fanatics. The Sentry faction is nuts. The rest of us are trying to stay alive.
You sent an unauthorized message to an unknown vessel in direct violation of Directive 1. You're as bad as the rest of them. Each side ready to go to war, and me trying to keep us battle-ready against the real enemy. Do you realize how hard that is? Turned out it was impossible.
Lee paced the small holding cell.
Yes, I lost my power little by little. It didn't help that my first officer lost his energy a half decade ago. He's an old man now. My sister turned on me. Nobody else stepped forward who wasn't caught up in his fanaticism. I'm asking for your help, Co. Whatever little respect I've still got from the crew will go to opening up fully. There's no reason not to. The enemy knows where we are. You'll get everything you wanted. The only thing you won't get is command of this battle station.
He turned back around to see Co still watching him through narrowed eyes. He waited for her to respond. At last, she rose to her feet. Okay, Commander. Let's go. He put out a hand to palm open the lock, but Co took his wrist. No need for that, it's all settled.
She put her own hand out, and the light above the door turned from red to blue.
The door swung open, and the so-called prisoner, never really confined as it turned out, strolled out, gesturing for him to follow.
Chapter 11. Captain Tolvern crouched behind a stack of crates in the main engineering bay. She had an assault rifle slung over her shoulder and wore a bandolier of grenades. The hull vibrated, and the tang of burning plastic and oil filled the hangar. Every few seconds came a terrific screeching sound. That would be plating pipes and ducts being pulled away by whoever was cutting their way carefully inside. The enemy had had ample chance to destroy the ship and the crew, but was apparently trying to take both more or less intact. Tolvern took in the others beside her. Cap, the former Royal Marine, checked her hand cannon, chomping on a huge wad of gum as she moved methodically through her ammo and weapons. Only the sweat glistening on her buzzed scalp betrayed emotion. Smythe fiddled with his hand computer, readying some surprises. Carvalho, loaded with guns, knives, and grenades, stood to one side, exposed away from the others. Hands on his hips, his muscles bulging from his t-shirt, he stared with disdain at the spot in the wall where the future breach would occur. Other crew members were scattered around the engineering bay, taking position behind stacks of supplies, pieces of equipment, and in a bunker made out of tools and broken pieces of Tyrellium armor.
"Why do I feel we've all been here before?" Tolvern said.
Smythe looked up from his computer.
"You mean like when that pirate tried to steal our ship on San Pablo?"
Carvalho nodded. "Or those times on Hot Barca. Second time was the worst. Thought we'd never make it out of there alive."
"How about Albion?" Cap said with a loud sigh.
"All that silver, but no way to steal it. Who knew silver bars were so heavy?"
"It's coming back to me," Tolvern said.
"We've faced a few enemies, haven't we?"
"Right, Captain," Cap said. "Nothing new. These ain't the buzzards, just a bunch of funny-talking humans. Should be easy enough to handle."
Tolvern couldn't afford to be so complacent, though at least she didn't have to worry about her intestines being plucked out by an overgrown turkey. A few hours ago, they'd been preparing to be boarded by Apex. This was almost a relief in comparison. It explained why she was facing none of the usual battle nerves, stupid as that was. She still might die, after all. The sound of tearing and cutting was getting on Tolvern's nerves. Get it over with already.
"Smythe, send that audio one more time," she said. "Give them one more chance to avoid all this stupidity."
He punched something on his computer to send the truce request, demand, threat. There was a pause as they waited for a response that had not come before, and would apparently not come now either. After a moment, he shook his head.
"They're still jamming it. Want me to try something else?"
"Throw a few bombs against their station," Cap said. "That will get their attention."
She blew a big bubble with her gum.
"Forget it," Tolvern said. "A girl keeps sending the same message and she starts to look desperate, you know?"
Cap laughed and the bubble exploded against her face. She peeled it off, still grinning.
"You see a bloke you like, you gotta jump his bones, Captain."
Carvalho rolled his eyes. Then suddenly, he stiffened as a fresh screech sounded.
"They're almost through. Get over here, you idiot," Cap said,
her smile gone in an instant.
You'll get your head blown off standing out there exposed.
He ducked behind the crates with the rest of them. Quiet conversations had been taking place across the open engineering bay, but now they stopped. A man sat at a heavy machine gun about 30 feet away, packed behind more crates, and with a gun shield to protect his head. He pulled back the bolt. The wall bulged on the other side of the engineering bay.
Hull pressure steady, Smythe said, computer still in hand. Whatever they're up to, they're not trying to suck us into space.
Holes popped in three places in a series of small explosions, and smoke poured into the room. Goggles came down over a few heads, but that wasn't necessary. The onboard filtration system sucked it out as fast as it came in, being designed to whisk away smoke in case of a fire. Figures poured through the holes, firing as they emerged. Blackbeard's defenders answered back, cutting down the invaders as fast as they entered. A bright flash temporarily blinded Tolvern, and when her eyesight recovered, she saw more figures pouring down from above, dropping 20 feet to the ground. The enemy had done something funny to the gravity, bypassed the onboard system somehow, and Tolvern felt suddenly as if she were floating. Cap cursed next to her and grabbed hold of one of the crates. It, too, started lifting off the ground. Then the gravity returned. The whole thing was over in a second, but not before a good 20 or more enemies had dropped in from above, fallen gently to the floor of the large room, and fanned out shooting. One fell to a knee, a gun at his shoulder, only yards away, but Carvalho dropped him with a single shot before he could fire. Tolvern got her good first look at the attackers. They were all dark-haired, like most Ladinos, but with an unusual look about their eyes, carried across generations and several hundred years of time from the Great Migration. She'd seen that same look in refugees, but these weren't the hollow-faced, pathetic remnants of Apex's depredations that had come flooding through the room-controlled space. They were quick-moving, well-fed, and aggressive military men and women. A rocket streaked toward her and she threw herself down. It detonated against the crates, and a small fireball went up. The heat of it curled over the top and sucked the air out of her lungs, but the wall of crates itself was impenetrable. The crates contained 2-foot-square patches of pterillium for the shields, and there was no possible hand weapon that would penetrate them. Tolvern poked her head up. Dead and dying enemies lay sprawled around the engineering bay floor, but not as many as she'd hoped. Worse, the Singaporeans who dropped in from above had bypassed the defenders and killed a few of Tolvern's people positioned behind a forklift. They used the forklift as cover to chase the defenders away from that side of the bay. Their fellows ran to join them and take over other positions. The battle was getting away from her in a hurry.
Time for the foam, Tolvern told Smythe.
A half-smile touched his mouth, and he tapped his screen, a boy with a toy. Nozzles emerged from the floor, ceiling, and walls. Smythe had bypassed the automated systems that Jane would have employed against a fire, and the foam that squirted out was aimed at enemies, at the breaches in the walls. The most critical danger in any starship was loss of atmosphere. You could lose a gun, even your engines, and possibly survive. But if the hull were breached and could not be sealed, that was the end. The space lanes carried many ghost ships whose crews had been lost this way, and who would pick their way endlessly across the galaxy on whatever trajectory they'd been following at the time. Bomb-proofs, airlocks, and deck isolation were 3 strategies to limit the damage. When that failed, the sealant foam. Now it was directed against the invaders from the battle station. It formed huge, frothy mounds where it hit, and immediately began to harden. Enemies were caught half in and half out of the breaches in the wall. Others were pinned to the floor and immobilized up to their necks. The foam entirely buried a few unfortunates, who struggled like insects sinking in pitch, before the casing hardened and left them entombed. The biggest mass fell on the captured forklift, where the enemies had been establishing a base of operations. That ended the threat from that direction. Tolvern hadn't known what to expect from Smythe's innovation. A diversion? A weapon that would catch both friend and foe at the same time? The result was beyond her expectations. How many had vanished beneath the foam entirely? 10 or 15? Another 20 caught and immobilized? And the entry points blocked entirely.
Several stragglers escaped the blast, but they either threw down their weapons and surrendered, or fought on and died in a hailstorm of bullets. It was all over in a hurry. Blackbeard's defenders rose from their positions, slapping hands and shouting. Several broke into a Royal Navy drinking song, and Cap jumped on top of the crates to lead them, half singing, half shouting in a lusty voice.
"Hold your cheers!"
Tolvern barked into the comm over the general channel.
"This isn't over. I want those prisoners disarmed and out of here, and every one of you back at your posts."
She reloaded her weapon and waited for the second attack. The wait dragged on, and only gradually did it dawn on the captain that there wouldn't be another attempt. Not now, at least. So she put her crew back to work. Barker's engineers suited up and began stripping away burned crating to get at the undamaged beryllium patches. Using the mechanized suits, they carried the heavy plates to the holes torn through the wall by the invaders and fastened them into place. The air filled with the purple arc of plasma welders, and an almost citrus smell from the epoxy that would fuse the plates together.
"It's going to be the ugliest repair you ever saw," Barker told her. "But they won't be knocking through the same place twice. I've got some of my people behind there, too, looking at whatever ducts and pipes they ripped apart getting in here."
"I can see them working back there," she said. "If they don't hurry up, you're going to barricade them between the hulls."
A grin stretched his mustache.
"Gotta keep them motivated. And if that doesn't work, I can slowly withdraw the oxygen."
"Barker, speaking theoretically, if we could blast our way clear of this base, could we make a run for it?"
"You mean, will she hold together?"
"Right, Chief. What shape will the hull be in once you're done patching?"
He looked at her as if she were nuts.
"The only thing holding us together is that the damn base is hugging us so tight. Moment it stops, we fly into a dozen pieces."
"I want that fixed."
"Sure, give me a Navy dock and 100 trained men, 200 tons of pterillium, some gun carriages, a new plasma engine, the works. I'll have her in tip-top shape. Short of that, I don't know what would do it. The finger of God? It's going to take a biblical miracle to get us back in the fight."
Tolvern let her expression harden, but kept her tone light.
"So what you're saying is that I need to barricade the lot of you down here and slowly withdraw the oxygen."
Barker's mustache twitched.
"I'll do what I can."
Tolvern clapped him on the shoulder.
"That's all I'm asking. Merely the impossible done with supernatural speed."
She turned her attention to the Singaporeans now being cut free from the foam and dragged off to join their comrades. Cap and Carvalho zip-tied their hands behind their backs, then marched them over to stand in front of the captain. Clumps of hardened foam still clung to their bodies, and they carried the bitter tang of fire retardant about them. Tolvern looked them over as they were lined up in front of her. Roughly 20 in all, an even mix of men and women, every face surly, as if they'd been the ones attacked without provocation instead of being the instigators of the fight. It was a curiously mature group, with the average age appearing somewhere around 35 or 40 years old. They looked vaguely Chinese, like from ancient pictures. But on closer inspection there were differences. Time and ethnic drift had blurred some of the old Earth resemblance, but it was a strong and hearty bunch no matter their ages.
"This is probably a waste of time," she said, "but I don't suppose any of you speak English?"
Blank faces greeted her words.
"Bloody idiots," Cap muttered.
"If one of you does," Tolvern continued, "or if you have a comlink hooked to a computer that can translate, let me tell you this. We didn't come here as your enemies. Your miserable treachery aside, I'm willing to forget it all. But it ends now. I want to talk to your commander, understand? We might still be able to come to an accommodation."
"Would you like me to try in Ladino?" Carvalho said. "There may have been Ladino traders out here."
"Sure, why not?"
Not much point in it, but it couldn't hurt. The Ladino language was a mix of Old Earth Spanish and Portuguese, and even more muddled by the passage of time than English. Carvalho rattled off something that came with the speed of a machine gun. One long word to Tolvern's ears. More blank looks.
"Guess that settles that," Cap said. "We'll lock this lot up and get to work." "Send Smythe to the cell block," Tolvern said. "See if he can get them to talk and record their words. Then we can let Jane have a stab at it." The computer should have samples of Chinese in the database.
The congestion in the engineering bay didn't ease for long after Carvalho marched the prisoners out. More crew were arriving every minute. Cap handpicked several to join her security detail to guard against another attack, while Barker put the rest to work on repairs. Tolvern had other matters on her mind by the time she left the engineering bay. The corridors outside were deserted. A strange thrumming noise came through the ducts, and the artificial gravity wasn't working properly. She practically bounced between one set of airlocks, gravity at 10 or 20%, while in the next her limbs felt like they'd been turned to cement. Every breath was a struggle until she got out. The science lab doors were repeatedly sliding open and shut as she passed. Tolvern had seen this sort of thing before, and figured they must have become misaligned after the ship took a hit. A safety feature designed to protect stray fingers forced them open every time they were on the verge of sealing, at which point they'd attempt to close again. Tolvern had been on her way to the bridge to consult with Jane and study the damage and readiness reports, but those doors were going to drive her crazy. She reached out to disable them and glanced inside. A familiar figure in a white lab coat hunched over a piece of equipment, muttering to himself.
"Brockett? What the devil are you doing in here?"
The science officer looked up from his microscope and blinked myopically.
"It's definitely organic, not epoxy and not a freeze-dried fluid leak from the ship."
Tolvern flipped open the control next to the doors and pressed the button to keep them open.
"Wasn't that driving you crazy?"
He put on his glasses and peered at her.
"Wasn't what?"
"The opening and closing and...
never mind that.
Why aren't you down in the bay? Smythe is down there running diagnostics, something you are qualified to do too."
"Does he need my help?"
"Of course he needs your help. What do you think we're doing here? There's too much to do without screwing around up here with your experiments. Put that huge brain of yours to work and keep our ship from flying apart."
Brockett gave a dismissive wave of the hand.
"I'm not studying space barnacles in here, Captain. It's this freeze-dried substance Carvalho scraped from the ship."
"Whatever that gunk is, it can wait. They'll be scraping freeze-dried science, officer, if we don't do something."
"Even if the gunk is an excretion from an apex queen?"
Tolvern was already turning back to the corridor, but now she stopped and stared at him.
"That's right," Brockett nodded. "You remember we have studied two different varieties of apex, closely related, perhaps of the same origin, but genetically modified over time. They say there are other varieties, all manner of drone birds of various sizes and abilities, a whole caste system within the colonies."
"And?"
"But for the sake of argument, let's say there are two basic types. There's the kind with the plumage, the queens, much rarer, and the sterile drones. The drone is the offspring of the queen, but undergoes further genetic manipulation either in the egg or shortly after birth. That's where you get the sterile warrior and worker caste."
"Fascinating stuff, but what the devil does it have to do with the space snot?"
"I've run it through the sequencer. The apex analogy to DNA, a complex protein with genetic material encapsulated, is clearly present in the sample Carvalho collected from the hull. It's an excretion, some sort of mucus-like substance from a specialized gland."
"You're saying an apex queen sneezed on Blackbeard's hull?"
"If by sneezed you mean mixed its saliva with a protective gel and an artificial epoxy and fired it against our ship, then yes. She sneezed on us, sir. I don't know why."
Tolvern took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
"But suffice it to say there's a damn good reason."
"One may assume so, yes."
"Have you touched the snot in any way with your bare hands?"
"No, sir, the substance has not come into contact with the air either."
"Good. Incinerated."
"But, sir..."
"You've studied a sample, you must know what it is down to the molecular level. Maybe there's more to learn, maybe not, but we don't know what this is and I won't risk it. Whatever reason this queen had for flinging her snot at us, you can bet it's something nasty."
"Yes, sir, I understand. And I suppose we could scrape off some more if we decide we need it."
"When you find a tick on your body, you crush it, Brockett. You don't leave it there sucking your blood. We're going to scorch it off the hull."
Tolvern reached for her comlink to speak to engineering. Smythe answered. She told him what she wanted done.
"I'll pass that to the chief," he said. "But I was just about to call you anyway. I've cracked the Chinese thing."
"The Chinese thing?"
Tolvern blinked, unsure she'd heard correctly.
"Wait, you have? You can talk to them? It's been 10 minutes.
Yep, I got it. Figured it out on my own. The tech officer sounded pleased, almost smug.
So I should tell Brockett to clean out his desk. We've got a new genius on board.
Brockett looked up with a scowl when she said his name. She waved him back to his work.
Or is this a trick?
A bit of a trick, a bit of genius. Meet me in the cell block. I'm ready to give it a try.
Brockett had already disposed of the sample when she entered the call, forcing it and the entire glass vial into the incinerator to be broken down to the atomic level and recycled.
I really hate to leave my work here, he began reluctantly. But if you say Smythe needs my help...
Hold on. Is there anything new to learn from the existing data?
Maybe, maybe not. It would be hard to tell if I'm not in the lab.
Fine, keep at it. New knowledge about Apex is the only thing that trumps emergency repairs.
Re-entering the corridor, Tolvern braced herself for more funny business with the gravity, but that had been stabilized. The strange clanking noise was louder, however, like some pipe was about to burst and vent corrosive chemicals. Tolvern cocked her head. A muffled voice reached her ear from behind the wall, followed by more clanking. An echoed curse. Ah, it was just the sound of someone deep in the ducts, banging around. She found her tech officer at the head of the cell block, messing around with his hand computer. A strange sing-song tone of a foreign language emerged from the device, and Smythe tried to repeat it, with hilarious results. He sounded like a man at the bottom of a well, pinching his nose and trying to sing purposefully off-key.
"It's like music," Smythe said excitedly when she approached. "You have to say the word and the note for it to make sense. Listen to these two words."
He looked at his computer and said something unintelligible.
"This is your plan? You're going to learn Old Earth Chinese?"
"No, I'm just curious. Hey, I wonder if Jane could speak it. She has a full database of Chinese."
"Even if she could, that Chinese is 500 years old. And these people were from a small Chinese colony, not even the main country. Jane's Chinese will sound like old church English would to us, at best. Totally incomprehensible."
"Worse than that," he said cheerfully. "Apparently what we called Chinese wasn't even one language in those days. People with one dialect couldn't understand people with another. They were roughly as close as English is to Dutch."
"So are you just wasting my time here or what?"
"Look," Smythe said, holding out his computer for her to look at the screen. It was filled with what looked like scribbles. She had read enough about Earth to recognize it as Chinese letters, but otherwise it may as well have been a transcript of a Hroom whistle language for all she could decipher. "The thing is, written Chinese isn't phonetic," Smythe said. "That's why the different dialects were considered the same language. The symbols stood for ideas, not letters. There are thousands of different characters if you want to write properly."
"How did anyone learn to read?"
"Not easily, I'm guessing. Anyway, the point is, you could get two people together from different places and times, and they might not be able to understand each other's speech, but the writing was the same. And look," he added, "I can write something in English, and the computer will spit out the Chinese letters."
"It's still been 500 years, Smythe. I can't read Old Earth English, can you?"
"Captain, no, that's not how it works. Because the writing doesn't match the speech at all. It's not phonetic in any way. There's no reason for the writing to have changed. I'll bet you anything that they write exactly the same as they did before the Great Migration." Ah, now she got it. Write it in Chinese and they'd understand. That didn't mean these people would cooperate, but they had a way to communicate. Tolvern gestured at the cell block.
"Go ahead. Let's give your theory a try."
Smythe stopped in front of one of the cells. "Cap thinks this fellow is the leader. The other captives seem to defer to him. And she threw him in his own cell. The rest are crammed in 6 or 7 to a room." Tolvern peered in through the small window. A strong-looking man sat on a cot, his hands still fastened behind his back. He was glaring at the wall. She checked her sidearm.
"This one looks like trouble," she said. "Grab an extra zip tie in case we need to clip his ankles, too."
Smythe went to the cabinet at the head of the cell block and patted a pocket of his jumpsuit when he returned. "Got it."
"Keep wary," she warned,
as she lifted her palm to the reader. When Smythe looked ready, she slapped the reader and stepped inside. Her warning proved prescient. The instant the door opened, The prisoner sprang to his feet and charged at her with his head lowered. Chapter 12. The prisoner had kept his hands behind his back, but that was a feint, and they weren't restrained. Somehow he'd got his hands free, and he grabbed for her throat with one hand and her gun with the other. He was quick and strong, and if Tolvern had stumbled into the room blind, he'd have had her. But she'd been tense, ready. She drove her knee into his gut, and he fell back with a grunt. Before he could recover, she had the gun out and pistol-whipped him across the temple. He went down hard, and Smythe jumped on top of him while Tolvern holstered her gun. Together they wrestled him onto the cot, shoved him face down with knees in his back, and attached the spare zip tie Smythe had grabbed from the head of the cell block. They got his hands bound just as he seemed to recover his wits. He tried to thrash free but got nowhere. Tolvern's heart was pounding. Her face flushed as she took a step back.
"You idiot! You think that's the first time someone has tried to jump me?"
He shouted something back in Chinese. Smythe picked up his computer and turned it over, as if checking it for blemishes. He was breathing hard.
"Forget this jerk," he said. "I'm sure we can find someone more cooperative. This is a negotiation as much as an interrogation. He's either their leader, or he's not."
But was he? Tolvern looked him over, taking in his dark, angry gaze, as he stared at her hard enough to drill holes in her head. The plastic cuffs lay on the floor, chewed in two. He must be flexible to have tucked his legs up and got his arms in front of him. There was a camera to watch the room, but that only helped if someone was monitoring the feed. And the truth was, studying prisoners was not currently the best use of resources.
"Translate a message," Tolvern said. "Let's see if he understands something simple first. How about, we're not here to fight you, we're enemies of Apex."
"I don't think it's going to translate Apex," Smythe said.
"Okay, then pick some other words. The enemy birds, or something."
Smythe tapped at his computer.
"I have a suspicion that this is going to translate funny. That we're here to fight the war chickens or something. War chickens battle buzzards. The turkeys of terror, close enough, you'll get it."
She took the console from Smythe when he'd finished and held it in front of the man's face to show him the Chinese characters. He looked away with a disinterested sneer. Tolvern's face went hot.
"You look at this or I'll work you over, so help me."
He still wouldn't do it. She slapped his face. When he looked up, shock and outrage burning in his eyes, she shoved the computer screen in front of him. He still wouldn't look.
"Smythe, call Carvalho, tell him to bring his knife."
This time there was real heat in her voice, and maybe it was only the tone, but the man finally looked. His eyes moved across the characters. Then he shook his head.
"What does that mean?" Tolvern asked. "Does he not agree, or does he not understand?"
And then the man spoke.
"I understand."
She looked down at him in shock.
"What did you say?"
"I say that I understand your words and I can be speaking back to you."
His pronunciation was perfectly correct. And even more strangely, he was speaking with her own accent. Tolvern had been born and raised on the small island of Auckland in the Zealand Islands, and there was a sing-song quality to its accent that she'd recognize anywhere. Somehow this man was using it. Yet there was something slightly off in his word choice. "I can be speaking back to you."
"How did you do that?" she demanded.
He looked up at her with a toothy, predatory smile.
"Everything we know about you already, Captain Jess Tolvern of HMS Blackbeard. We know these and others."
Again with the disturbing version of her own accent coupled with strange grammar.
"Smythe, what's going on here?"
The tech officer didn't look nearly as disturbed as she felt.
"It's your message. He must have learned from it somehow."
"There wasn't enough there to learn English, and he's completely fluent."
"Not completely," Smythe said. "The good accent makes the word choice seem even stranger, makes him sound like an idiot."
A flash of anger from the prisoner.
"You wait and see. We'll be better soon."
Tolvern drew in her breath, still unsettled. Something occurred to her.
"He's learning from us as we talk. That's what's going on. He picked up the basics from my transmission, stole my accent, and now he's perfecting his English with every sentence. I don't know how, but he's got some sort of accelerated learning thing going on."
"It must be a comm chip," Smythe said. "An implant, like Nibpim's navchip, except instead of handling advanced mathematical calculations, it's connected to the language centers of the brain. Do you think we should, go into the hallway to talk?
Tolvern shook her head.
You know what? I don't care. Even if he does sound like me, it doesn't matter. He's got plenty of English as it is. In fact, I'll bet Cap and Carvalho chattered the whole way up here. They gave him enough to work with.
Then what do?
We assume he understands everything and conduct the interrogation accordingly. If he gets more fluent as we go, so much the better.
She grunted.
Thank God he didn't pick up Cap's accent instead of mine. Imagine if we get into the base and they're all talking like Yorktown drunks and pickpockets.
When you reach the base, it will be as prisoners, the Singaporean said, his brow furrowed. No, as...
No, we won't, Tolvern said. We'll come in on equal terms or as conquerors. Your choice.
Never.
What do you want with us? Why did you attack?
You led the war chickens to us.
War chickens? She said. That was a joke, you idiot. Apex. That's the word you're looking for.
Because of you, that makes you an enemy. Apex used you for...
Again he trailed off. Didn't have all the words yet, did he, the cocky fool?
You do know that your civilization is in ruins, right? Tolvern said. The survivors are fleeing by the millions, and we've been taking them in. I came out here to help.
Your ship is full of holes. It would not survive a fight. You cannot help.
This is one ship of a whole fleet. We have new tactics, new weapons. We're working with the Hroom now. We only want to share what we have. Use your resources to knock the buzzards out of the sector. Maybe wipe them out for good.
Fight here with our people, not in your own systems.
Apex knows where you are, and they won't rest until they wipe you out. Your battle station is compromised.
We were hidden before you came.
Stupidly, she said. Build a fortress and keep it hidden while your home world is destroyed? That makes no sense.
He didn't answer, so she pressed on.
You are blocking our transmissions. We tried to tell you of our peaceful intentions, but you were preventing us from doing so. Why?
We only demand your surrender. Nothing else matters.
You didn't demand a damn thing. You tethered us and tried to board. And how did that work out for you anyway?
A temporary problem, the man said. You're caught and you can't get away. We'll come again.
And we'll knock you back in the dirt when you do. How many of your men and women are dead or prisoners because of your stupid attack?
It doesn't matter. We have more crew than you.
Not if you lose them at a 10-to-1 ratio. It's only a question of time until you can't even defend your own base.
We will see.
His English was improving moment by moment, the strange elements to his sentence structure vanishing, with less searching for words.
What's your name? She asked.
She didn't expect him to answer, but he defiantly met her gaze.
Jeremy Megat.
An English first name and a Chinese last name. Did you know that on Earth, Singapore was part of the British Empire? Albion was settled by the Anglosphere, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and some Americans. Our ancestors were allies before. They could be allies again.
Megat is a Malay name, not Chinese, he answered. It was a mixed colony of people, and your people were colonizers on Earth. Exploiters of Malay and Chinese alike. They wanted us only as labor for their empire.
Tolvern didn't know the history, but it didn't matter. It was hundreds of years ago, and carrying those grudges into space was ridiculous. She was getting nowhere, and had to figure out how to reach someone more reasonable than Megat.
Who's your commander, and how can I talk to him?
Megat didn't answer.
Who sent us the message? She pressed. The Fibonacci sequence.
A twinge in his expression.
Nobody sent a message. Our base is a silent sentinel. It does not send messages.
You fool, I can see you're lying. It's all over your face. Someone sent that message and you know it. Instead of voicing this aloud, she said,
I want to talk to your commander. If he tells me to my face that he wants nothing to do with Albion, that he wants to sit here rotting away, then we'll leave.
You won't leave. We are taking your ship and seizing your crew.
Megat smiled.
That is only a question of time, as you say.
Tolvern returned to the bridge to discover it empty. Smythe and Lomelie were down in engineering, as was Cap. And even the pilot was out, down in the gunnery, using his nav chip to help recalibrate guns that had been knocked off their carriages. A tech had come in and stripped open several consoles, leaving exposed wires and hardware boards. Strips of cut cable lay across the floor. The viewscreen showed the gas giant off starboard, around which both they and the battle station were slowly orbiting. A vast swirling eye lingered below them, a storm that could have swallowed the entire planet of Albion whole. Other moons and asteroids reflected glints of the distant sun, and icy rings encircled the planet in a swath that arced from top to bottom on the viewscreen. She changed the view to port. Now the Singaporean battle station dominated the screen. Megat's so-called Silent Sentinel was a series of interconnected rings, with unidentified globules on the interior and two hexagonal structures stacked on top of each other on the exterior, glowing a cool blue like backlit sapphires. Turn off the filter that was cutting out the sun, and that light would disappear. The entire structure would look like background space, melting into whatever it was viewed against. And the illusion wasn't purely visual. There was spectacular cloaking technology that hid them from passive and active scanning, too. The Admiralty would love to get its hands on that tech. The station was large, maybe 3 times the diameter of Blackbeard bow to stern. Plenty of living space in those globules, and maybe in the hexagons, too, although that was where the main weapons had appeared bristling to wipe out the Apex lances in a spectacular display of firepower. But unlike Royal Navy fortresses which were dug into captured asteroids or small moons, the whole structure was artificial, and frankly looked fragile. No doubt that was illusory, but it seemed to rely on secrecy and overwhelming firepower, not defense. Sure looked like it could use a Navy task force to keep the buzzards at arm's length. Why were they so unwilling to accept help? It didn't make sense. And then there was that message she'd received, the Fibonacci sequence. It was almost like the Singaporeans were trying to lure Blackbeard in all along, trying to snare her for their own purposes, strip her for parts and crew, apparently. Except, was that worth blowing her secrecy? Because Apex had also learned the location of the battle station, as it turned out. "You're schizophrenic, my friend," she said, as if the battle station were a person standing in front of her. "You don't know what you want, do you?" Barker called from the engineering bay.
"I still need a couple of days, Captain, but I can keep us from explosive decompression, that's something. Do you want me to send someone out to do some cutting?"
"I'd rather not tip our hand until we're ready."
"Not talking about the tether or the gravity net, but we've got these hoses sticking out of us. So long as they're attached, we are at risk of more boarders. If I cut them off, that gives me more crew to work with. No need for a bunch of our best workers to stand around holding rifles and picking their noses."
"Hold on, let me take a look."
Tolvern, still alone on the bridge, manipulated the display. There was no way to get a view of what Blackbeard looked like, gripped in the battle station's embrace, without sending out a sensor probe, which she didn't want to do. But she brought several cameras in for a tighter view, and could see a stretch of the hull at least. 3 large tubes plunged into Blackbeard, snaking over from one of the globules attached to the station's outermost ring. It looked parasitic, like the station was a giant creature attaching a trio of proboscises to drain its prey of fluids.
"You still there, Captain?" the chief asked.
Tolvern imagined his mustache twitching impatiently.
"Apologies, but I don't have time to wait on your musings."
"Don't cut the lines," she said.
"Yeah, all right, your call."
He didn't sound pleased.
"I think we'll hold together without them, though."
"It's not that. Is Cap around? Is she busy?"
"She's strapping into a power suit, going to haul out some broken pipes. Are you cooking something?"
"Keep working," Tolvern said. "I've got an idea that might buy you some more time."
She switched channels.
"Cap, you there?"
"Aye, Captain."
A grunt then to someone else.
"No, not like that. Give me the bigger clamp. The big one. Captain, I say we haul out those Chinese and make them do the grunt work. And if one of them gives me any lip, I'll clock him upside the head. In fact, I wouldn't mind giving all those fools a good beating. Did you know they killed Yats? That's right, the new guy took a bullet. 18 years old.
3 months in the Navy, and poor kid is already a goner. I'd like to take them Chinese and...
Shut up and listen, Cap.
Aye?
You'll get your chance to land some blows sooner than you think. Are you up for some more fighting?
Are you kidding? Of course I am.
Cap sounded instantly alert.
I hate this messing around fixing stuff while we wait for him to smash it all up again. What are we talking about?
Tolvern explained what she was thinking and why. Cap listened silently at first, but when the captain got to the good part, she let out a whoop of joy.
Damn right, Cap said.
She was already shouting at someone to get her out of the suit when the call ended. Chapter 13 Commander Lee figured he'd be challenged as he led the openers toward the command module. His sister had enjoyed plenty of time to consolidate her rule. Already she'd taken over fire control, expelling several openers and shooting two who resisted. Lee had 4 others with him, including Hillary Coe. All were armed, 3 with shotguns, 1 with a grenade launcher, and Lee with a pistol he'd collected from his quarters. He'd entered his rooms fearing that they'd been ransacked and his sidearm stolen from its cabinet, but they were untouched. Anna had been too busy to get to it. The 5 of them curved around the outer ring from the detention block, startling 2 women who had a wall disassembled and were messing around in a suspicious way with wires and computer boards. The women ran for it, and Ko threatened to shoot them in the back if they didn't stop. Lee ordered Ko to hold her fire. They soon discovered what the women had been about. The central transportation conduit was shut down, preventing an easy trip to the ring along the rail line. But nobody had yet disabled the service conduit, and they put on breathing masks and traveled in the airless expanse that passed behind the main conduit. Soon they were on the inside, approaching the command module, and had yet to be challenged. Where was everybody?
Hold here, he told the others as the corridor bent around a corner. Try sweating them one more time.
Ko had kept up a mumbled conversation through her comlink as they picked their way through the battle station. She'd been taking and sending all manner of calls, organizing her own people for the uprising, maneuvering them into parts of the base not yet under Anna Lee and Jeremy Maygott's control. Some of her expected allies had not answered, including Lee's second-in-command, Harold Ong, who'd apparently been sent out of the command module. Neither did Dong Swetnam, their only other man on the inside. Ko thought he'd already been purged, but Lee had his doubts. Who would Anna replace him with? The best communications people were all openers.
Sweat, are you there?
Ko tilted her head. She let out her breath in a hiss.
There you are. I thought they'd taken you out. Where the devil...
Yeah, uh-huh. She turned to Lee. He's alive. He's still on the inside. Her face darkened as she listened on. There's been an attack.
On who? Lee demanded. Us or them?
Ko didn't answer. She listened for a moment, nodding, as if Swetnam would be able to hear nods over the comm.
Got it, we're there in 60 seconds. Keep your head down when we enter.
She turned to one of the others, the man named Huang, whom Lee had originally sent to the power plant to keep him out of the way.
You have that charge? Good. Swetnam disabled the blast doors, but he can't get to the entrance. We'll need to knock it down to get in.
Hold on, Lee said. What's going on here? I demand to know.
Ko turned to him. Her gaze was calm, almost lizard-like, with her eyes half-closed. Once again he felt as though he were being pushed aside, and wondered if she would even bother to answer his question, or would tell him to shut up and stay out of the way. He'd be needed when she took over the base. If she took over the base, that was. If not, Anna had already shown herself happy to use him. Either way, Lee would be a puppet for the winning side, to lend legitimacy while heads rolled, while rule was consolidated, then tossed into the recycler with the rest of the surplus crew.
You still want us to take the command module, right? Ko asked. Or did you change your mind? Don't tell me you want to leave your sister in charge. She'll get us all killed.
Ko studied his face as she said this.
Good, I didn't think so. But for the love of your ancestors, can you stop being so indecisive?
Ko stopped and looked at him expectantly, as if waiting for an answer. Lee realized he was still in charge, thank God.
Yes, carry on.
We'll only have surprise for a moment. We've got to get in and take them out before we lose it. Ko turned to Huang and the others. Ready? Anyone you see, you shoot, got it? On my count. She gestured with a rifle. One, two, go!
They charged, and pistol in hand, Li ran after Ko and the others. They came around the corridor and down the final passageway. He'd expected a half dozen of his sister's people to be guarding the door, but there was only a single man with a shotgun. He was barely paying attention, and had only begun to lift his weapon before Ko and two of the others fired. Li brought his pistol up, but it was already over. The opponent slumped against the door in a smear of blood.
"Blow it down,"
Ko told Huang, as she took the gun from the dead man's hands and tossed it to Li.
"Only one guard," she added grimly. "Better than I hoped."
Li holstered his pistol and gripped the shotgun, which was still warm with the dead man's body heat. His heart was pounding, his stomach tight, but a strange calm had come over him. There were no decisions to be made here, only to follow Ko's orders as she sent him into battle. He could do this, follow orders, shoot and kill if needed. It was making the decision to kill that sent him spiraling into a black hole of doubt. Meanwhile, Huang unhooked an explosive charge about the size of his fist from his belt. He peeled off a piece of adhesive tape from the back of the charge and pressed it against the door. The charge wasn't shaped properly, having been taken from a collection of mining supplies, but it was more than enough to knock down the door, assuming Swetnam had disabled the heavier blast doors on the other side. Otherwise, they'd be stuck outside. Once the charge was in place, they ran back the way they'd come to take cover. Ko wasted no time once they were around the corner, pulling her computer from her hip pocket and punching in the command. Li gripped the shotgun under his arm to free his hands, which he then slapped over his ears. A muffled explosion went off. And then they were racing back down the corridor toward the command module. The blast had knocked a hole in the doors, a gaping, smoking opening big enough to slip through. Li was the last one inside. By the time he got inside the command module, a burst of gunfire was going off. Someone was shouting, and fire suppression systems sprayed foam at the burning doorway. The air smelled of gunpowder, burning plastic and chemical retardant.
"Hold your fire," Ko shouted. "It's over."
That was unnecessary, as the shooting had already stopped. Li saw Swetnam through the clearing smoke, his back against the wall, holding his leg and groaning. The doors were open on the far side, and there was nobody else in the command module, either dead or alive. Ko swung the gun over her shoulder and rushed to the downed man, cursing.
"Who shot you? Which one of them did this?"
"You did, you idiot," Swetnam said through clenched teeth.
Li went to Swetnam. He turned the man's leg to look at the wound, which was on the inner thigh.
"It's not that bad." "Don't touch me. Ow, please."
Ko moved to the far door and poked her head out to inspect the far corridor. She glanced back and took in Swetnam's wound. "A little higher and you'd be peeing sitting down."
"You shot me. Weren't any of you listening? I was yelling over the comm. I tried to tell you they all ran away when the blast went off. There was nobody else in here but me."
"Sorry, that's my fault," Ko said. "I gave the order. Why didn't you keep your head down like I told you?"
"I did. I was behind the command chair. You were just shooting so wildly."
He said all this through gasps of pain.
"Some of the shot must have ricocheted," Li said. "Come on, stand up. It's not so bad. A few small pellets is all, and they hit on a bounce. You're barely bleeding. We need you at the computers."
Swetnam grimaced as Li got him to his feet and helped him into one of the chairs at the communications console. Ko took another seat. Huang and the other three took position by the door, guns at the ready, in case the sentry faction mounted a counterattack.
"I thought for sure Anna and Megat would put up a fight," Li said. "Why did they run off?"
Swetnam's face was regaining some of his color.
"There were only three of them. They couldn't put up a fight."
"Who?"
"Your sister and a couple of others. Megat is gone. I'm sure he'd have stood his ground. What about the guard at the door?"
He glanced at the far side where they'd blasted their way in.
"You took care of him?"
"I still don't get it," Li said. "Anna was taking control of the whole base a couple of hours ago, and now she's run off.
Why didn't she put up a fight?
Ko shook her head, looking equally confused. One guard and only three enemies in the command module. Maybe we overestimated the strength of the sentry faction. They were cowards when it came right down to it.
You're wrong, Swetnam said. He was grimacing again, the fingers from one hand digging into his leg near but not on the wound, while his other hand worked the console. While you were out in the ring figuring out how to mount an operation with five openers, Megat and Engineer Lee got 50 crew members armed.
He tapped his finger on the console and nodded toward the viewscreen.
There's your answer.
The view changed, and it showed three assault ducts thrusting out from the base to attach to the battered hull of the Albion warship.
They attacked Blackbeard already? Lee asked. Anna said it would take all shift to get ready.
Come on, I was there. That was an obvious lie.
So it's over.
The words sounded hollow as they came out. The sentry faction wiped out our allies, and my sister has 50 armed crew at her disposal. Meanwhile, we thought we'd won because we chased her out of the command module.
It's over, all right, Swetnam said. Just not in the way you think. The Blackbeard defenders wiped them out.
He explained what had happened. Several Singaporeans died in the initial attempt, while most of the rest had been trapped by a quick hardening foam. A handful escaped. It was unknown if the ones left behind had been taken prisoner or summarily executed. Either way, almost the entire force of Singaporeans had vanished, including Jeremy Megat. Ko snorted when Swetnam had finished.
Idiots, what did they think would happen? Make a half-hearted rush at a warship, filled with armed, angry people fighting on their own turf. We'll be lucky if the Albionish don't turn their guns on us and blow us apart.
If they do that, they'd be destroyed too, Swetnam said.
Maybe that's the way to go, Ko said. Better than knocking around here acting like idiots until the end of time.
Except that we've won, Lee said. He heard the wonder in his own voice. It's the end of the sentry faction.
The news had first come as a slap to the face, that 50 men and women he'd lived with and known for 11 years were gone just like that. But Anna's failed attack had saved his base.
Not the end at all, Ko said. Half the base is still sentry faction. There must be 200 of them still around to muck things up.
But Megat is gone, the plan discredited. Nobody will stand by my sister now. All we have to do is convince the Albionish that it was a mistake, and hope these idiots of ours didn't permanently piss them off. Ko, see if you can open a channel to their ship. Swetnam, pull back those battle ducts. Make sure they reseal the breach on the way out, so we don't vent their atmosphere. You can do that?
Yes, sir. Should I also release the magnet and let them go?
Not yet. Once they fly off, we won't get them back. Let Ko have a chance at showing them the olive branch first.
Lee glanced at Huang, still positioned at the door with the two others.
I don't know who else you have armed and ready, but I want my sister found before she causes any more trouble. Oh, and get more security up here. We don't want to fall to the same trick we pulled ourselves.
The view screen turned black. Lee thought it was Swetnam or Ko messing around with the display. But then a familiar face filled the screen. Anna.
Hello, brother. I guess you've heard about my little setback?
There was no change to the arrogant turn of her lip.
Give it up, Anna. It's over. Megat's gone. We have the command module, we have fire control, we have everything you need to make war. There's nothing more you can do. We are going to make a truce with the Albionish.
You've won nothing, she said. My people are everywhere.
We're spreading the word. You're a failure, a traitor. What you did is far worse than anything the Albion people did. And your followers will desert you. There's no reason for a sentry faction anymore. Apex knows we're here, and now we need all the help we can get.
Her smile became even more arrogant, until it was almost a sneer.
You think you're clever because you have command, communications, and fire control? I have food, I have power.
We'll go hungry if we have to. And you can cut power to my parts of the base, but I can run on auxiliary until we hook up to Blackbeard's power plant. And when Apex reappears, would you still stand off stubbornly while we're destroyed for lack of power?
How about water? Can you do without that? How about oxygen?
Now Lee scoffed.
You cut off our oxygen supplies, and you'll be the first to suffocate. The command module has its own scrubbers. That gives me 3 days. By the time they run out, you'll be blue and stiff, and I'll turn the system back on.
I'll blow them apart. You'll never get them back on.
Suicide, that's your plan. You're insane.
Insane, maybe, but serious, yes. He could see it in the set to her jaw.
Someone cut her off, he said. I'm sick of looking at her face and listening to her treason and lies.
Ko hit some buttons. There was some resistance from the partially compromised system, and Anna stared, willing him to do it. At last, Ko managed to cut the connection, and the screen returned to its view of the assault ducts, connecting them to HMS Blackbeard.
Come on, Sweat, Ko piped up. Get those pipes retracted already.
Right, Lee grumbled. How are we supposed to convince them we're not hostile while we've still got our tube shoved into their orifices?
I can't, Swetnam said. The seals won't deploy. They seem to have been deliberately torn out by the Albionish.
You must be wrong, Lee said. Why would they do that?
I figure they're trying to damage the ducts any way they can, Swetnam said. Keep us from trying another attack down the line.
But for now, it simply leaves them connected to our ship. What's to keep another 50 men from running down the duct, firing away as they jump in? Ko,
he started to say, then stopped when he saw her expression. She'd raised her eyebrows, and her mouth was slightly open. A look of understanding dawned in her eyes.
You're right, Commander. Anyone can run down the ducts, Ko said. In either direction.
Chapter 14. To those on Blackbeard, it felt as though Tolvern's ship were being hugged in a death grip by the Singaporean battle station. But the distances were deceptive when one was used to dealing in measurements of millions of miles, or even light years. The tunnels connecting the ship to the base were nearly 400 meters long. As soon as they entered, Tolvern and her assault group saw that the invaders had ridden on rail cars, which had no doubt zipped them across in seconds, but nobody could figure out how to activate the cars to fling Blackbeard's crew across in the opposite direction. At least not figure it out fast enough for the captain to keep messing around with it. What's more, the gravity disappeared the instant they got outside of Blackbeard's hull, and presumably wouldn't resume until they'd gained the battle station. That's when Chief Engineer Barker came up with the clever idea of sending several of them across on boarding rockets. That was how Blackbeard got inside disabled enemy warships, streaking through the vacuum on a wire. But instead of flying through the vacuum, they simply followed the tunnels, sending the boarding rockets back and forth to get all 50 members of the assault group across. It was roughly half the crew, with the other half staying behind to continue emergency repairs. Tolvern was leaving no defenders to repel a counterattack. She was going all in. If the Singaporeans mounted any sort of operation in the interim, anything at all, Blackbeard was finished. The captain had a hunch, a strong one, and meant to take her chances. Tolvern was in the last group across, sitting with Smythe and two others, straddling a boarding rocket. It launched, and they were off. Air blasted her face, and momentum jerked her body back in the harness. Tiny lights on the inside of the tunnel turned into a single smear of blue. And then she was jerking to a stop on the other end, and Cap was pulling her off.
You all right, Captain?
Good enough.
Tolvern swung her assault rifle over her shoulder and thumbed off the safety as she pointed it at the ground.
Let's go.
The passageway out of the duct connecting ship to battle station was larger than she was accustomed to in the tight confines of a Punisher-class cruiser. The ceiling was more than 9 feet high, and the corridor was wide enough for three to walk abreast. The lighting was a cool white, not the more natural yellow on Blackbeard. And the air was warmer and more humid than she was accustomed to, hardly the tropical hell of hot Barca by any stretch, but clearly set for people accustomed to a different climate. From the exterior, the battle station had appeared as sets of rings with other structures built against the interior, but it was all a maze of passages and lifts in here. Signs marked various passages, but though Smythe could scan and translate the literal meaning of Chinese characters, the English version came across as gibberish. Element control, suppression of fullness,
alimentary, natural, unusual and unnecessary, and the like. "I'm making a map as we go," Smythe said, as they came to the first Blackbeard-controlled checkpoint, where three of Tolvern's crew had forced half a dozen prisoners to lie face down on the floor. The tech officer pointed to a passage on his right. "I think that direction is where we'll find what passes for the bridge." "What does that sign say?" she asked, pointing to the Chinese letters. He frowned. "Potency skillful. Better than alimentary natural. That sounded like an herbal anti-constipation remedy." Lieutenant Cap had gone ahead with several more crew, and Tolvern caught up with her a few minutes later. Cap had taken some more prisoners and was trying to interrogate them. Five more Blackbeard crew were up ahead securing the next passageway, and Tolvern held until she got word. She studied Cap as the woman tried to menace and threaten information out of the Singaporeans, who answered back, but not in English. "King's balls," Cap said. "It's no good, Captain. Thought maybe these blokes could talk English like that one we caught on Blackbeard. But it's just that singy jabbering." She poked one of them in the back with her rifle as he looked up. "Plenty agreeable, though. Don't figure none of them will give us trouble. As mellow as a home sugar eater waiting for their next fix of the white stuff." Tolvern remembered the fierce battle in the engineering bay, how the Singaporeans had taken the initiative. "Don't count on it. These ones are probably just techs." "Hey," Smythe said. "No offense, Smythe. Or maybe they're the ones on our side." "You still sticking with that theory?" Cap asked. "It makes sense, doesn't it? Someone sending us a message, someone else trying to kill us. A quick attack, followed by nothing. No armed response when we got over here." Tolvern nodded, feeling more confident as the words came out, confirmed by the last 15 minutes as they'd already taken over a good section of the Singaporean base without opposition. "There's some struggle going on here," she added. "One side wants to kill us, one side doesn't." "If that's the case, then where's all the killy people?" Cap asked. "And how do we take care of them?"
"I think we'll find them nearby, in potency skillful."
"Huh? What?" Cap said.
"The bridge," Tolvern told her, pointing to one of the Chinese signs. "It's that way. Capture their bridge, and the rest of the base is ours. Assuming most of the killy people fell into our hands over on Blackbeard, we might not even have much of a fight."
That all sounded logical, but when had it ever been that easy? Never in any battle Tolvern had ever fought, and after a decade in the Navy, fighting Hroom, Albion traitors, pirates, and Apex, she'd been in her fair share. Something always went wrong, and it wasn't always immediately apparent what. So she was curious, perhaps overly so, as they followed the signs leading them to the bridge. When they got to the last corridor, she held position, while Carvalho and three others jogged up and joined them. Together with Cap and Smythe, they made 7 in all. It would have to be enough. Cap poked her head around the corner. She pulled back, scowling.
"Looks like someone beat us to the party. What do you make of that, Captain?"
Tolvern looked. A man slumped dead on the floor. Looked like gunshot. The doors behind him had a hole blown in them, big enough for people to go through. Her hands itched on her assault rifle. An unknown, and Tolvern didn't like unknowns.
"Go in hard and fast," she said, "but hold your fire unless they shoot first."
"You must fancy getting shot full of owls," Cap said. "Shoot first, hold fire later. That's my vote."
"You don't get a vote, Lieutenant. We need prisoners, a forced alliance at the barrel of the gun if necessary. Kill them all and that will be hard to do."
"Thought the bad guys had the bridge. Let's waste them and make arrangements with those what survive."
"I do not like this plan," Carvalho said. His voice was tight, his accent thicker than usual. "I do not like these Chinese at all."
"Shut up, both of you," Tolvern said.
When they'd complied, she gave a curt nod.
"That's better. On my count. Ready? Go."
They broke into a run. It was all silent until they came onto the bridge, with Tolvern behind Cap and Carvalho, and 4 others behind her. Carvalho shouted in Ladino. Cap yelled her own orders. Someone on the other end shouted in Chinese, and Tolvern thought shooting would break out before she could calm matters. There were 2 men and a woman on the bridge. One of the men had sprung to his feet and carried a pistol, which he waved back and forth between Cap and Carvalho, jabbering excitedly. The other 2 Singaporeans shouted at him, and seemed to be yelling for him to put down the weapon. He was a thin, middle-aged man, probably a technician, and seemed uncomfortable with the gun. The other two had dropped their weapons to their feet. Tolvern came in from the side and grabbed the older man's wrist. Carvalho sprang in, and together they wrenched the pistol away, while Camp and the others from Blackbeard pointed their guns in the faces of the two remaining people. They didn't resist. Once they had the weapons scooped up, Tolvern lined up the three prisoners. The older man was talking quickly, pleading something. The younger man leaned against him for support. He had a wound on his inner thigh. Must have come during the attack that left the dead man in the corridor outside.
"Calm down, will you?" she said. "Quiet!"
They ignored her and carried on. She looked them over, trying to determine ranks. They had dragon and tiger pins on their collars, but the uniforms were otherwise identical. The two men looked helpless, confused, even frightened. Only the woman held herself with any confidence. She was speaking with the other two in a quiet but insistent voice, and they calmed down. She must be in charge.
"Smythe, get your translator and ask this woman her name. Is she the base commander or a mutineer?"
While he worked at his computer, Tolvern took a look around. The command module, the so-called potency skillful, was smaller in diameter than Blackbeard's bridge, but with a higher ceiling. A closed door on the other side matched the destroyed door on this one. It seemed to be an exit, rather than a doorway to a separate chamber like Blackbeard's war room. Other than that, the command room was more or less the same as a bridge on a Royal Navy warship, with its consoles and viewscreen. The large screen was split into several panels that showed views of interior corridors and open spaces. In some of these, Singaporeans were running in one direction or another. Another screen showed three of Tolvern's crew taking position with their rifles at their shoulders. A final panel showed a large open room with towers of hanging plants, a hydroponic farm from the look of it. Curiously, a man with a knife was hacking off hanging vines laden with tomatoes and letting them fall to the ground. Smythe held up his computer with the Chinese letters. The woman glanced at it, eyes moving over the screen. She hesitated, glanced at the older man to her right, then shook her head and pointed to him.
"She must think we're idiots," Cap said. "This bloke's not in charge."
The other woman said something and pointed to the tiger pin on the man's collar, then to the dragon on her own.
"What's that, then?" Cap said. "Does tiger trump dragon?"
"We'll figure it out soon enough," Tolvern said. "Smythe, tell him to stand down, to order all forces to stop fighting. We'll see if he's in charge or not."
Smythe showed the new message, and the older man said something and gestured up at the viewscreen. He pointed at the man cutting tomato plants in the hydroponic farms.
"I don't care about your harvest or whatever it is you're doing," Tolvern said. "Your crew will stand down, do you understand? Everyone put down their weapons, approach our people in a non-threatening manner, and surrender. I'll send a message to my own people not to shoot, then we'll talk."
This was a lot to translate, and as Smythe did so, the female Singaporean tried to move back to her console. Carvalho blocked her with his gun. She let out a rapid-fire protest. The other three crew from Blackbeard had moved to guard the doors, but now they came back. Guns leveled, as it seemed there would be trouble. Again, the man the Singaporeans had fingered as being in charge gestured urgently at the viewscreen. He kept talking, waving his hands about.
"Let the woman sit," Tolvern said. "I don't know what's going on, but she's worked up about it."
"She's gonna pull something," Cap grumbled.
"Let her try."
Tolvern checked her comlink. It was full of chatter, but nothing rose to a level of urgency. Nobody was shooting at them, apparently. And until that happened, Tolvern could afford to be lenient. The older man kept gesturing at the screen showing the hydroponic farms as the woman worked the console.
"So he's cutting tomatoes," Tolvern said. "What does that matter? Smythe, give him your computer. Let him put in his own words."
"That doesn't work that way," Smythe said. "There's no way to input Chinese characters, only English words, and then they can be translated."
Tolvern grunted.
"So we can communicate in one direction only. Lovely. Suggestions, anyone?"
The man kept talking through this, faster and more urgently with every moment, when suddenly his words switched to English.
"And she's going to go all the way. She's..."
He stopped, blinking, then turned slack-jawed to the woman at the console, who grinned.
"Blimey," Cap said. "I put through the link to your implant," the woman told the older man, "and to mine and the rest of them."
The sudden switch to English was shocking, but not so shocking as it would have been if Tolvern hadn't already heard one of her captives do it. Hopefully these two would be more cooperative than Jeremy Megod.
"Nifty bit of tech you've got there," Tolvern said. "Now, what the devil is going on? Who is in charge? Is it you?"
she asked, pointing to the older man.
"What's your name and rank?"
"John Lee, commander of Sentinel 3, Tiger rank in the Singapore Imperium."
"Assuming that's true," Tolvern said, still unimpressed with his military demeanor, "I want a general order to stand down, then we'll talk, and you can tell me what's so blasted important about your tomato harvest."
"I've already given the order so much as I can."
"He's speaking in complete correct sentences," Smythe said. "Remember how that first guy was struggling? This is all at once."
"It's all plugged in together," the woman at the console said. She was still working and didn't look up as she spoke. "What one person learns, the entire network can share with the rest."
"And who are you?" Tolvern demanded. "Hillary Coe, tech officer."
"You'll have to show me that," Smythe said. There was envy in his voice. "We've got nothing like that in the fleet."
"Smythe," Tolvern warned, "you are sharing unauthorized information."
"Sorry, Captain."
She turned back to Commander Lee.
"If you gave the order to stand down, why were you waving your gun around when we entered?"
"I already had it out when you came in. I was going to take out the bullets. We saw you coming, and I wasn't going to put up a fight. Really, I wasn't."
"Oh, you weren't, were you?"
"I swear it," Lee said. "I don't have enough crew on my side to fight, even if I wanted to. And I don't want to fight, I never did. Believe me, I wasn't going to shoot."
"You could have just dropped the thing and held up your hands."
"Yes, I should have. I froze."
The woman at the console looked up long enough for Tolvern to see her raised eyebrows and a glance at the other man. What was that, lack of confidence in their commander or something else?
"Hillary Coe?" Tolvern asked the other one. "That's your name? What is your role in this?"
"It was me who sent you the message, the Fibonacci sequence, so you'd know how to find us."
"And you?"
Tolvern asked the man with the gunshot wound to the thigh.
"Engineer Dong Swetnam, I'm the one who deciphered your original message. We're openers. We never wanted to fight you, that was a mistake. That was the other side, the Sentry faction. They're insane."
All of this confirmed what she'd already suspected, and she found herself believing their story. Cautiously, of course. Time would tell the truth.
"I've got some of your so-called Sentry faction on my ship," Tolvern said. "We killed several and took the rest prisoner. The leader is a man named Jeremy Megart, or that's the name he gave, anyway."
"Megart isn't their leader," Lee said. "Although he's certainly one of them, the head of the Sentry faction is my sister, Anna."
"So you've got a mutiny on your hands, is that it? And your sister is the head of the mutineers?"
Tolvern glanced at the viewscreen. A second man had joined the one cutting down the tomato plants. Together they hacked at the hanging plants growing up the column, and not very skillfully. Stems laden with blossoms fell in heaps to the ground.
"What's going on in there?" she asked. "Something to do with your mutiny?"
"That's my sister's doing," Lee said. "Destroying our farms to prove that she's serious about maintaining our isolation."
Tolvern laughed at the naivety of the action.
"Your isolation is gone. We know you're here. Apex knows you're here. What I see is pointless destruction and nothing more."
"That seems obvious enough," Lee said. "Unless you're a fanatic. After 11 years of isolation, most of my crew are fanatics. It's a religion now, and you can't argue religion with people."
"Present company included?" Tolvern asked. "Are Coe and Swetnam fanatics too?"
"We are realists," Coe said, her tone sharp. "It's not religion, it's common sense."
"I don't care tuppence for your farms," Tolvern said. "Blackbeard carries food supplies for a long haul into deep space, and in a pinch can fabricate proteins, fats, and simple carbohydrates, the kind of food that keeps you alive and running to the toilet every 20 minutes. They'll last both ship and station long enough to get Blackbeard fixed up while we wait for resupply from the Navy."
"It's not about the food," Lee said. "That's just a message. It's my sister showing that she's willing to destroy it all."
Let her have her message. We won't run out of food or water or...
or oxygen.
Tolvern stopped and stared. Her own damaged oxygen plant had never stopped gnawing at the back of her mind.
That's right, Lee continued. We've scanned your ship and you're leaking air. If you don't share our atmosphere, you're going to suffocate. And I'm afraid I've got some bad news on that front. It's not just the farms that the mutineers have taken control of.
Chapter 15. Captain Tolvern decided that the trio of Lee, Ko, and Swetnam posed little danger. So she sent Carvalho and most of the rest off to continue securing as much of the base as she could. She kept Cap and Smythe with her in the command module and sent for a medic to treat Swetnam's leg wound. One soon arrived from Blackbeard, and the injury proved superficial. For a stretch, it seemed as though the base would be taken without a serious fight. Scattered resistance broke out every few minutes, but most of the Singaporeans were either flocking to surrender en masse or retreating to less accessible parts of the base, the power plant, the farms, and the water, septic, and recycling center. And, of course, falling back to the oxygen plant and atmospheric recycling system. To get to the plant, you had to pass through the farms in the center of the base. There were several access points to the farms, and Tolvern ordered Carvalho to take them. But the enemy had already organized resistance. Carvalho fell back under heavy fire. He asked for 20 more fighters. Tolvern didn't have them, and wouldn't until they'd consolidated their control elsewhere in the base. Meanwhile, Lee familiarized Captain Tolvern with the command module while he explained the political situation on the Sentinel battle station and in the Imperium as a whole. Singapore had fought a brief, brutal war with Apex about a dozen years earlier. It started when the bird-like aliens captured 2 million settlers on a colony planet 2 jumps from the homeworld, and if they hadn't stopped to ritually slaughter and devour their captives, would have made it to the homeworld as well. As it was, Singapore threw up a hasty defense and fought the enemy to a stalemate. After Apex withdrew, Singapore built the Sentinel battle stations, 11 in all, hidden along the space lanes leading to jump points into the home system. Apex's strength was communication, its weakness, detection. Sentinel 3 bristled with armaments, including the new and fearsome Eliminon battery, which had remained untested when the battle station was put in place and ordered into silence.
At least never tested against the enemy, Lee said.
With 11 battle stations, I'm sure they've been tested by now, Tolvern said, and found wanting.
We expected the birds to return within a few months, maybe a year or two at the most, Lee said. But year after year went by without combat. I don't know where they went or why they didn't come through the system.
Tolvern didn't say anything. It was a weak excuse to justify years of inaction.
What else could I do? Lee said. I had my orders.
I've never seen orders that asked a man to be an idiot for the cause.
You're right, of course. He shook his head. I know what you must think.
Captain Tolvern studied her counterpart. Lee seemed like a smart, honest man put in a difficult position. 11 years of isolation. Tolvern had been on deep space cruises that had lasted 11 weeks, and those were long, hard slogs if you couldn't put into port once in a while. Even 6-month tours of deep space were not unheard of for Navy missions. The Admiralty periodically sent a long expedition to probe the lawless systems that blocked contact with old Earth. But the crew enduring them still enjoyed communication with the fleet via subspace messages, and usually knew how long they would be out. Lee had none of those advantages, an undefined mission, an uncertain fate. Half his crew seemed to have gone insane, including some who were his supposed allies. But still, the man had surrendered his base without a whimper and had yet to contradict a single one of Tolvern's orders. She'd got more pushback from Cohen Swetnam than from the base commander. The truth was, John Lee was relieved to be relieved. From duty, that was. She could see it on his face and hear it in his voice. Relieved not to be making life and death decisions, but mostly relieved not to answer the one question that seemed to have plagued him for more than a decade. Should he obey his original orders, even when the people who'd issued them had apparently vanished from the universe?
What about Singapore? Lee asked. What's happening on the homeworld?
Tolvern wasn't ready to answer that question. Instead, she said,
I can't help but wonder what would have happened if you'd tried to communicate with the Imperium.
We'd have been discovered, and then attacked.
And what is the problem with that? You are a battle station, are you not? Not a sentry station, or a comfort station, or a wait-and-see-what-happens station. Your duty is to battle the enemy, is it not?
Of course we were going to fight. Eventually. Our first battle was to be a surprise attack, an overwhelming victory. You saw what we did to Apex when they didn't expect us.
You defeated a handful of lancers. A skirmish, it means nothing.
Tolvern shook her head.
So you'd have given up your location. You might have been killed. But you'd have made an accounting of yourselves. Maybe wiped out enough Apex ships to buy Singapore more time. Years, maybe even generations if you hit the buzzards hard enough. Time to prepare, to build your fleet and make alliances with other humans and aliens in the sector.
Tolvern paused to let her words sink in.
You didn't. And now your civilization lies in ruins.
At this, Ko and Swetnam turned quickly. They'd been sitting with Smythe, helping him learn and interface with the battle station consoles, but obviously listening with one ear.
What news of Singapore? Ko asked, her voice strained. You know everything, don't you?
Captain Tolvern, Commander Lee said quietly. What has happened? Why are there refugees? Who is leading the Imperium?
There is no such thing as the Imperium, Tolvern said.
Her stomach felt heavy, the news as bitter in her mouth as raw garlic.
Not anymore. Your colonies are gone. Your fleet destroyed down to the last ship.
Oh my God, Lee said.
A few 100,000 Singaporeans escaped, maybe as many as 1 million, and are fleeing through the Froom Worlds, trying to reach safety. But no more will escape the planet. It is surrounded by a large Apex fleet.
And is there a harvester ship in orbit around Singapore? Lee asked.
Yes, and it has been busy.
Ko let out a small cry. She buried her head in her hands. The woman had seemed the strongest of the three Singaporeans, but now her body shook as she wept. Swetnam had turned grey, and he looked stunned, like a man who'd stood too close to a cannon as it fired and been left addled in the brain. But what about the Sentinels? Lee asked, his voice catching again. They were to have stopped the enemy. The Eliminon batteries. They were new. The enemy knew nothing about them.
Apex tactics also evolve. I don't know what happened. We've only got refugees to tell us, and no ex-military personnel that I know of. But if the Sentinels fought, it wasn't enough. They couldn't keep Apex from your homeworld.
And you're sure? There was a desperate nature to the question. Singapore is gone, all gone? You're absolutely sure? Ko lifted her head. Tears streaked her face. Her eyes widened, almost begging the Albion captain to give good news. But Tolvern had none to give.
There were over 100 million people on your world, Tolvern said gently. Maybe half of them were still alive after the atomic bombardment. And now they're harvesting the survivors.
Lee looked stunned. Then they'll slaughter us all.
That is what the buzzards do, Commander. They are apex predators. That is why they must be fought and defeated. They devour the weak. They only respect strength. They once fought a brutal war against the Froom Empire and vanished for generations after the Froom fought them off. Now that the Froom are weakened by decay, civil war, and sugar addiction, Apex has returned. That's why they left Singapore alone for a while, because she fought them off, proved herself strong. Except that she wasn't strong enough. And now she has been destroyed.
I know, but harvested? 50 million dead. 50 million more. Harvested. The three Singaporeans were still gaping, visibly trying to come to grips with this, when Smythe looked up.
I've got the bridge, Captain. Nib Pim is at the helm. Put him on.
The Hroom's long purple face brought excited remarks from the Singaporeans, and their English vanished into a stream of Chinese. Had they ever actually seen a Hroom before? Certainly they didn't seem to expect one on the bridge of the Albion warship.
Apparently my presence has caused a stir,
he said in his high, almost hooting voice. This brought fresh exclamations. Never mind them. What about the ship?
Barker wants to test the remaining engine, unless the Singaporeans have a spare one lying around that we could borrow.
Doubtful, pilot. Highly doubtful.
More critically, Barker says we need CO2 scrubbers as soon as possible, unless they have an atmosphere converter they want to loan us.
Tolvern let out her breath. Let's say neither of those things are possible for now. I'm working on it, but we've got some oxygen issues on our end, too.
I see. This will pose difficulties.
I am aware of that, pilot. What else?
Structurally, we can fight as soon as we are untethered and free from the gravity net, but we can only fly, and our shields are almost non-existent. The first enemy salvo will destroy us. We will also be vulnerable to boarders. Apex is likely to notice that and send them over.
I need armor, she said.
Every available patch has been put to use. It is only enough to stop the leaking.
We might be able to help you with that, Lee said. She turned to him. What do you mean, might? I mean we have spare armor, enough to reinforce your ship. Unfortunately, it is down in the armory. In other words, your sister has it. Yes, Captain Tolvern. She turned back to her call with Nib Pym. Tell Barker I'll do what I can. No oxygen for now. He'd better figure it out on his own. Barring that, I suggest you all take a deep breath and hold it.
Is that a joke, sir?
Gallows humor. Anything else? We're still knee-deep in it over here.
Yes, there is one other thing, Captain,
the Vroom said.
As the enemy knows exactly where we are already, I have taken the liberty of composing a subspace message for the Admiralty. It would tell Admiral Drake of our predicament, our contact with the Singaporeans, the fight with the Apex Lancers, and our desperate need for assistance.
Send it. Tolvern gnawed on her lip. If the fleet is where I think it is, it will take them weeks to reinforce us. And I'm pretty sure we don't have that kind of time. But I suppose we'd better make the attempt, if only to pass along the info before we die. She wished she could tell Albion more. Unfortunately, the power demands required to send a subspace message between systems were such that the message must be stripped to the bare minimum. No chance to share all the helpful information discovered, from the Apex tactics to the strange organic substance that had been spit onto the ship's hull. Not to mention the treasure trove of information she expected to get from Commander Lee and his crew. Assuming they could avoid suffocating, dying at the hands of mutineers, and being served up at a Queen Commander's banquet. Well then, Captain Tolvern, you'll just have to stay alive, won't you? When the call with her pilot ended, she got an update from Carvalho, who had a solution to his manpower shortage. He wanted permission to arm some Singaporeans to help him push against the mutineers. Not so many he couldn't control them, about 20 or 30. She approved his plan, but wanted the Singaporeans